Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers. FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements when black leadership rose. But we still here, finna build here, up coin sale, bro. Show. They got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity is so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black on, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth a crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fuck me promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin sale, bro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, cause that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
There's a kind of a fundamental basis for post-traumatic slave syndrome. How many of you are familiar with post-traumatic stress disorder? Yeah. Okay. So these are things, I mean, most of you are people who are in the field that have done the work. You're here representing the people who are really in the trenches, and I appreciate and respect that. The theory very often, when people hear it, post-traumatic slave syndrome, I try to kind of get at kind of what's going on in the room. There's ambivalence, there's feelings of, you know, what? Come on now. What are we saying now about the slavery thing? It's over. You know, it's get over it. You know, we're done. We have that kind of feeling. And how possibly is she drawing a connection between something that happened so long ago in contemporary society. You know, come on, are you trying to find an excuse? Are you trying to blame people? You know, these are the natural kind of knee-jerk reactions to hearing the term post-traumatic slave syndrome. However, I would submit to you that, you know, it's based on research. So I did about 6 years of research specifically looking at violence. My area of focus is violence. And I'll cover that in my my PowerPoint. Also, some of you may not be able to see points of the PowerPoint, but we're going to make it available to you. So you don't have to worry about it. There's a website where you'll be able to download my PowerPoint. Isn't that correct? Did I say that right? Okay. So that part you don't have to worry about. But I kind of want to set the ground so that we can all advance and move forward together. Now, the reason I do that and the reason why I begin that way is because there's an assumption, a fundamental assumption, in a room this size with people very well educated, people very well exposed, that we're all entering this discussion at the same level. And we are not. I can guarantee you we are not. We all have our ideas and our beliefs, and then we all have our experience. For example, the people of color that are in the room, all the people of color that are in this room are arriving in this room at a different level because they have lived in this skin. And we're rarely given any kind of appreciation or understanding of what you have to live with walking through the world with this skin. So you kind of come in at a different level of awareness about the discussion. And then you have folks that come into this discussion that are educated around it, that are clear about it, but can't really empathize their way through it. In other words, it's not a feeling thing, it's a cerebral thing. So some people stay intellectual because that's a level of comfort. Nothing wrong with that. But very different from the person who lives in the skin, it is personal and it is emotional. Okay, so all of that's going on in this room even before we get started. But as people commit it, you know, it may get a bit uncomfortable. But that's okay, because it's been uncomfortable living in this skin. It's been uncomfortable. And we have to learn how to deal with that discomfort and stay in the room. So when we look at the fundamental premise of trauma, and we understand the nature of trauma, we know that there have been other groups that we've looked at the etiology of their of contemporary behavior based on multi-generational trauma. One group, Jewish Holocaust, families of Jewish Holocaust, and the fact that the Jewish community is very, very clear about honoring that Holocaust. So much so that Spielberg will probably make another movie. And I'm not mad at him, because what he's doing is ensuring that the generations that come will never forget the Holocaust and its impact upon Jewish people. You'll look at folks throughout the world, even Aboriginal folks in the United States, where more focus is being done on what colonialism has done. We've looked at Japanese internment. We've looked at Australian Aboriginal folks. We've looked at multi-generational impact of trauma on people who have had tragedies, like the tsunami victims. We'll look at everybody. But when it comes to looking at Africans, there's a visceral response. Oh, come on, let's not. Why are you? And it's a curious thing as a social scientist to me that you get so much pushback when you talk about Africa. And we look at the legacy of slavery. You get so much pushback, but more importantly is why do you get the pushback? See, as a social scientist, I'm less concerned with the material, which I'm clear about. I'm more interested in why the behavior. Why is there such reticence at looking at this issue? And there's the answer is, when you peel back the layers of this, we peel back everybody's layers. Everyone gets naked in this room, and that's not always comfortable. It's also very comfortable to talk about the other's pathology. And the reason why I think that becomes important is so that when we begin to engage in this discussion, we don't find ourselves falling victim to the fear, guilt, all of that stuff that's not useful to anyone. It's not useful. This means we're going to peel the layers back. And while 246 years, as it were, in American history of American chattel slavery, starting with 1619 to the ratification of the 13th Amendment in the United States, we're looking at 246 years of American chattel slavery. And it's very comfortable, and I think to some degree people can say, you can't have 246 years of trauma and expect that nothing happened, especially when that trauma was followed by more trauma, especially given the fact that there was never a point of healing. Not difficult to do the math here. This is not deep and philosophical. It really makes sense. But you know what else is true? You can't have 246 years of folks engaged in a traumatic experience that were white that went unaffected. That means everybody has been affected and infected by this thing. So that's the part that gets uncomfortable, because it's usually okay to look at the other. We're going to look at everybody. This is going to be one where we really show the elephant in the room, and only for the purposes of recognizing that unless we do so, none of us can heal. This is not a process that any of us can do individually by ourselves. This is a collective process. And so therefore, we're all going to be engaged. And it's not just a pointing of fingers at anyone. It's recognizing that you and I, all of us, have been impacted by historical multi-generational trauma. Now, let's look at it very specifically. When we look at trauma in its very, you know, clinical sense, you know, my background in clinical psychology, understanding what trauma is, people can experience a single trauma, one trauma, indirectly, meaning that they didn't have to be present for the direct trauma. Meaning, say, for example, you all heard about 9/11 and taking down the buildings in New York, right? Yes? 9/11. Everybody in the world got told about that. Matter of fact, I think everybody in America got diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of that. But I would submit to you we were traumatized long before that. But there were individuals that were at ground zero, and I know them. My niece was in one of the buildings. So she decided, while she was in one of the buildings, they kept telling her, just stay where you are. They kept saying, stay where you are. We think people should stay where they are. She said, and everything in her mind said, get out. So she got out. Matter of fact, she leapt over the security guard to get out of the building. And it's a good thing she did. But during that time, there were people at ground zero, for example, like my niece. And there were people who watched it on television. And then there were people in other countries who heard about it. So there are varying levels of understanding around this trauma that happened in the United States. There were people at ground zero, were there, had saw folks falling out the sky, got videotaped footage of it, watched it on television, invited folks over and drank beer, not traumatized, no trauma. There were people in maybe in another country, in Brazil, saw it on television, in psychotherapy right now, can't get on planes, on medication, and people talk softly to them twice a week. So the variance in terms of those who are traumatized by a traumatic event and those who are not, we're unique as individuals. Everybody's not traumatized by a traumatic event, whether it's direct or not. But when we start talking about chattel slavery, we're not talking about one trauma. We're not talking about a specific event. We're talking about generations of trauma with no intervention. Based on what I know about sugar plantations, tobacco, and the Caribbean, what I know about American chattel slavery and the plantations there, does anyone right now ever recall mental health assistance to slaves? Anybody remember sending in the therapist after I sold off your son, daughter, raped folks? At any point? Never. Second question. After slavery was officially over, now you're free. Anybody remember any therapy then? We know it's been rough, it's been deep for you, it's been difficult, we're going to do a little group therapy. Anybody remember that? That would be no. Number three, after slavery officially ended, both in the States, in the Caribbean, the British ended, do you remember whether or not trauma continued? Did the trauma continue for people of African descent? I need to know. Okay, so now let's do the math. Hundreds of years of trauma, no treatment. Freed, More trauma, no treatment. What do you do to math? Do you think there may be residual impacts of that trauma? Of course there is. It didn't end, friends, and it hasn't ended yet. So I think, on one point, African people and people of African descent are extremely resilient. Matter of fact, I think we're a miracle. Far be it for us to pathologize or to look and cast this idea of weak and sick people. Oh, on the contrary, we are profoundly resilient because we've done everything we've done thus far with no help, with not even the ability to have this discussion. As though it were possible, we escaped injury in all those hundreds of years and the years that follow. So this kind of journey I'm going to take you on is going to be one that really gives a perspective on what this trauma was, what it looks like, and clinically, what is post-traumatic stress disorder? What does it look like? Now, let me give you a little snapshot. We'll get into it in more depth a little later. But post-traumatic stress disorder, if in fact you are diagnosed with that, again, remember, direct or indirect trauma, here are some of the symptoms. A feeling of foreshortened future. Now, what does that mean? A feeling, well, you're not going to live long. How many of you are running into young people that don't believe they're going to make it past their 20s? Feeling of foreshortened future. Exaggerated startle response. Outbursts of anger. Difficulty falling or staying asleep. Hypervigilance. Right? These are symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. This is like DSM stuff, Diagnostic Statistical Manual Mental Disorders. It's in there. And there's a whole listing of all these symptoms. Now, I want to roll it back so you can understand what the transmission theory is, because I'm going to talk about transmission. So how does a person that's been traumatized by post-traumatic, literally has a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, and can we, if we are logical and we are reasonable people, assume that a fair number of Africans had to have had post-traumatic stress disorder, you think? I'm not talking about us, I'm talking about them. Untreated, though, right? Okay, so now let's do the math. Mom, who saw dad sold or sister raped, has post-traumatic stress disorder. Still mom, though, right? Only mom now has outbursts of anger, feeling of foreshortened future, difficulty falling or staying asleep, hypervigilance. That would be mom. Now, Johnny or Mary or Shaquisha did not have the original trauma. But what are they learning? This is called social learning theory. What am I normalizing? Exaggerated startle response. Outbursts of anger. Are you following me? So I didn't have to be traumatized. Now, the other thing is, do you think Johnny and Mary got traumatized too? Do you see? So what happens in your environment, you learn from the significant others in your environment. And if they're broken, guess what you're going to be? You're learning from broken people. And you're normalizing that behavior. And then it becomes, years later, 2008, that's their culture. That's just the way they are. That's their culture. So there's poison in the cookies, right? But how are you going to tease out that poison? That means you have to look at the etiology of the behavior, which is what I spent many years doing. And it's not rocket science. This is not deep. Like I said, this is not required that, you know, someone has, you know, it's just common sense. How many of you in the room think you can cook? Come on now. I know it's a strange place. You all have the oddest food in the world. I'm trying to tell you that now. Those of you that know how to cook, who taught you how to cook? Mom, dad, family. Who you think taught them? Hello, social learning theory. You learn from those in your environment. And if they couldn't cook, yeah, likelihood is you can't eat. Okay. So there's things that we don't question them. This is what goes in the curry. What are you talking about? This is how you make curry. Well, how you know? Because that's the way my mother made it. Well, maybe, you know, she didn't get the recipe right. Actually, I wrote Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, the book, which is here. The book is called Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, America's Legacy of Enduring Injury and Healing. I recently have written a study guide, which is being edited now. But the reason why I wrote the book is really to put a name to what I was looking at. I started to look at behaviors in African people and people of African descent. A long time, people asked me all the time. I just was interviewed by ABC, and they wanted to know, where did this come from? It came from growing up black. No, there's nothing deep there. I grew up looking at black folks and wondering why we behaved the way we did. Very little had to do with white people. Very little. I was looking at black people, and I wanted to understand our behavior. I am 50 years old, and I remember looking at people who were, growing up in South Central Los Angeles. That's where I grew up. My parents are from the South, from Louisiana, and from Belize. And one of the things that I started to notice are certain behaviors that black people engaged in that I started realizing, not just African Americans, African Caribbean people, I came here, heard the same thing, behaviors around what we look like, for example, I would hear people, and you all, most people here, white or black or wherever you are in the spectrum, you've seen the behavior and wondered about it. I know you have because I wondered about it. Well, you have black people that aren't black. How many people have met black people that actually aren't black? Now, this is an interesting phenomenon. These are black people that will tell you before, first of all, they certainly look black to me. They look black, but they don't say they're black. I've got quite a bit of Indian in me. Did I mention that a lot of my family are from, all of a sudden there's something else, right? And you're looking going, sure could have fooled me, you look black to me, right? Now this would be something that I could ignore if it stopped when I was a child in South Central, but it didn't. You could hear it in rap music today. Same behavior. Matter of fact, the rap videos, that they just need to clone the same girl, right? I can draw her right now, what she looks like. The little wavy hair and, she's black but not too black, okay? And what is that about? What is its etiology and why does it persist? That means that it's an intracultural phenomenon that's being passed along through generations. But why? What is this self-loathing that I see in contemporary black folks? I'm not going back to slavery. I'm talking about today, who hate and despise the reflection in the mirror. That's what I wanted to know. So that's what led me on my journey, if you will. Again, not an unusual journey. Of course, I'm going to kind of pop back and forth through British history and American history. James Madison was a very important figure in American history, president of the United States, 1751 to 1836. He said, blacks are inhabitants but as debased by servitude below the equal level of free inhabitants, which regards the slave as divested of two-fifths of the man. This is the Three-Fifths Compromise. And what they were trying to figure out is, what are we going to do? How are we going to count these black folks? Because, based on how many people you have residing in a particular state, the more representatives you can send to the House of Representatives, and thus the more power that particular state can wield. So the question was, how do you count the slaves? Well, Southerners, who, of course, enjoyed slavery, they wanted to count them. They said, yeah, count them. That gives us more power. Where the Northerners saw it as an opportunity to abolish slavery, said, well, you can't count them because you don't consider them human. How can you count people who have absolutely no freedom that you do not count or treat as human beings? So the agreed-upon solution is to count three-fifths of a state's total slave population. And so as a result, they became three-fifths of a man, divested of that. But it's almost as though you're not talking about a human being anymore. And that's what's scary about this. And I always start my talks by saying that when you see folks dressed up like this, and I know you all see a lot of them, you should get worried. I always get concerned when I see them dressed up like that, like this guy here. This next guy was someone that I struggled with. You all know him, Richard Oswald. He's the son of a Presbyterian minister, international trader of enslaved Africans. What's so deep about this gentleman is how wealthy he became as a result. He would be worth, based on the 1700s, right now he would be worth $68 million. Based on the number of slaves, the slave trade and colonies, ships, all the stuff that he basically utilized. But again, these folks are held in high regard. When I read about him in your history, you would never know. Google him. You'd never know the ugly trade that he was engaged in because we've sanitized it, you see. It all got kind of sanitized. But what's important is to understand the wealth amassed. And see, this is where people get afraid, particularly Europeans. This is where the whole, oh, my God, dare I say the big ugly word, most folks are afraid of, because we don't really care too much about the healing, that healing stuff. Go on and get better, you people. But don't try to touch the resources. That would be reparations. We don't want to have that conversation. We're okay if you all go heal, however you're going to do that. But let's not talk about the reparation story. But when you start looking at the wealth amassed, and then you got to look at the Church of England. It gets real ugly because then you start realizing what is a foundation for the Church of England. Folks that blessed the slave ships. And then, of course, and this is interesting about John Newton because we all know about, the first thing you hear, John Newton, what's the next thing you hear? Amazing Grace. John Newton, Amazing Grace. Well, let's figure out what happened before he got Amazing Grace. He said slaves are lesser creatures without Christian souls and thus are not destined for the next world. Now, what becomes important about this kind, and you'll see it both in American history as well, and there is this kind of dehumanization of African people. Because you got to ask yourself this question, how do people who deem themselves superior, who see themselves as the civilizers, who recognize themselves as the what we call manifest destiny, the white man's burden of civilizing all the rest of the races, how do you reconcile being the superior being and engaging in barbaric behavior? What that produces is something called cognitive dissonance. How many people are familiar with that? Cognitive dissonance is really thinking discord. It's when you begin to feel conflict between what you believe or understand or hold to be true, and you are then faced with behaviors, either in yourself or others, that conflict with your fundamental belief. It produces cognitive dissonance. Human beings don't function well with cognitive dissonance. You must remove the cognitive dissonance in order to function. So in order for people to perpetuate slavery, and to perpetuate that whole system that lasts for centuries, you had to remove all dissonance associated with it. Can't be anything wrong with me. Certainly isn't us. We're the civilizers. We're the superiors. So it must be them. Oh, yes. Well, you see, they don't even have souls. Now I can go to sleep because I'm not really dealing with a human being. Are you following me? Okay, let's see what else he said. He said, when the women and girls are taken on board a ship naked, trembling, terrified, they are often exposed to the wanton rudeness of white savages. The prey is divided upon the spot. Look at the choice of words, the prey. Resistance or refusal would be utterly in vain. And then he says, I sinned with a high hand. Yeah, and then he wrote Amazing Grace. Okay. So it's really important to understand that hand in hand with the behavior was a mindset that is so damaging. You see, I call it the secret. Not the secret that everybody's been talking about, that secret. This secret is the kind that makes you sick. How many people here are in mental health, have done direct mental health treatment with folks? If you're not into, you know that the secrets make us sick, yes? Isn't it the secrets that cause people the pathology? Right? How long have white people had to hold this secret? How long and how many generations had to stop and pretend Grandpa didn't do what he did? That the wealth we enjoy was not on the backs of some of these little girls. Think about how long one had to keep that secret. And the only thing you could do is either pathologize the other. It's all their fault because it certainly wasn't great-granddad. Look how well he dresses. Do you understand what I'm saying? So when I say that this pathology goes hand in hand, I kid you not. Then you have science. And whenever we are in a process of trying to legitimize things, it's so amazing. You know, people always say this to me, even black people, when they hear about post-traumatic. Because you know it's not correct unless you can count it and measure it, right? Science is the final. It is the number one. If you can say it's scientific, then you basically trump everything else, right? Science determines reality. So if we can scientifically assert a thing to be true, then in fact it is true because it's scientifically proven. It's a scientific fact. Matter of fact, that's what people will tell you when you try to say to them, I don't know if I agree with you. You know, it's scientific. It's a scientific fact what I'm saying here, right? Which somehow makes it what? True. And it's also in a book. Now let's do the math. It's in a book and it's scientifically proven. Did anybody here realize that recently we lost the planet? Anybody know what planet we lost? How you lose a planet? You know, I became fond of the little picture with the, we lost a planet. We didn't lose a planet. You know what it means? Science was wrong. Now, have they ever said, you know, we were wrong about that planet thing? No. It's called a paradigm shift. So let's go to science, and I think it's important that we do. So we then, again, we go to someone named Carl von Linnaeus. Now, Carl von Linnaeus becomes an important character in this whole conspiracy of silence and legitimacy and removing the dissonance. Carl von Linnaeus developed a system based on a criterion of skin color and laid the basis for 19th century racial classification. Linnaeus properly began the science of anthropology. So here we have the father of anthropology. Although color classification of races dated back to the ancient Egyptians, anthropologists refer to Linnaeus's Systema Naturae of 1735 as the first modern study of man. While Linnaeus advanced classification with his use of a color criterion, he also fixed on his four families of man certain moral and intellectual peculiarities that continued into the 19th century anthropological vocabulary. He described Homo Americanus. Who might that be? That would be Native American, American Indians. Homo Americanus, and what did he say about them? He said they were reddish, choleric, obstinate, contented, and regulated by custom. Homo Europaeus, as white, fickle, sanguine, blue-eyed, gentle, and governed by laws. Homo Asiaticus, that'd be Asians, as sallow, gray, dignified, avaricious, and ruled by opinions. And Homo Afer, as black, phlegmatic, cunning, lazy, lustful, careless, and governed by caprice. These insights into what Linnaeus defined as racial character, personality traits, behavior, intelligence, language, and a host of other related categories were transmitted into subsequent attempts at a science of classification and became more fixed than the races themselves. Not a shred of science here. But it is in a book. And it's touted as science. And what's more important, you know, my students, I teach graduate students in social work. And they'll say, but Dr. Leary, my God, we're looking at 1707 to 1778. We are, right? After all. But do you not hear these same attributions today? You know those blacks, they're lazy, you know. All of the exact same, am I telling the truth? In your newspapers, in your accounts of them, do you not hear these very same things? So does it matter that it started in 1707 and 1778 and has no scientific merit? That's multi-generational, is it not? It's being passed along, part of the swallowing into the social gullet. Those are the beliefs, you see. So it doesn't matter whether it's true or not. And thank you, Carl von Linnaeus. Again, he's removing the cognitive what? Don't they deserve to be treated the way we treat them? Have we not just justified what we've done? After all, I just told you this is who they are. we're not wrong. We're just trying to keep the domestic tranquility. Makes sense. I'm having a clicker thing. There we go. Johann Friedrich Blumenbach. Just look at him. He's not right. We could tell already. But he had to contribute his part as well. He says, now this man, Johann Friedrich Blumenbach, he was an individual. How many of you are familiar with the term Caucasian? Oh, yes. Then you know Johann. He would designate five races or varieties of man in the second edition of his work on the natural variety of mankind. His division into Caucasian, Mongolian, American, Ethiopian, and Malayan races, with the added Carl von Linnaeus descriptive peculiarities, became the subsequent basis of most 19th century anthropomedical studies. While Carl von Linnaeus founded his system principally upon skin color, Blumenbach considered a combination of color, hair, skull, and facial characteristics as fundamental means for classifying the five varieties of man. Central to his study was the Caucasian, a term which he originated. He took the name Caucasian, listen for the science, from Mount Caucasus because its southern slope had cradled what he felt to be the most beautiful race of men, the Georgian. The Caucasus near Mount Ararat, upon which the biblical ark came to rest after the flood, seemed the appropriate source for the original race of man. No science yet. Now I'm going to quote him. These are his words. For in the first place, the stock displays, as we have seen, the most beautiful form of the skull, from which is a mean and primeval type, the others diverge by most easy gradations on both sides of the two ultimate extremes. That is, on the one side, the Mongolian, on the other, the Ethiopian. Besides, it is white in color. Anybody here ever met a skull that wasn't? Besides, it is white in color, which we may fairly assume to have been the primitive color of mankind. Zippity-doo-dah, no science, nothing to found this whole thing. He figured white skull, humanity began white. It's scary, but it's in a book, and it's touted as science, and we swallowed it without question. But race is a concept of society that insists there is genetic significance behind human variations in skin color that transcends outward appearance. However, race has no, thank you, has no scientific merit outside of sociological classifications. There are no significant genetic variations within the human species to justify the division of races. Mankind is one. We are one humanity. Isn't it a shame that we are still debating that in 2008? But the reason why we continue to debate it is we still try to reconcile the ugly stuff that we've never dealt with. We still want to say they deserved it, so no one has to feel bad about all of those little babies dying and ignoring the ravages of Africa and killing young black males and urban cities, all the and disproportionate imprisonment and disproportionate disparities in health. Oh, it must be their fault. How do you reconcile it? You see, rather than deal with it, we just continue to try to justify the behavior. Thomas Jefferson, you all know him? Yes, he's one of my favorite people, actually. I close out my book with a soliloquy from Thomas Jefferson. I actually end my book with it. Because Thomas Jefferson made a statement. Here's a man highly regarded in the United States. I mean, there are more statues of him than probably anybody. And he made a statement towards the end of his life. He says, "Indeed, I tremble for my country when I consider that God is just and that his justice cannot sleep forever." You see, it haunted him to his grave. Because Thomas Jefferson knew. He knew what would happen. Matter of fact, he predicted exactly what we're dealing with today, what happened between people of African descent and those of European descent. Predicted it. He was a bright man. How do you reconcile behaving in such a barbaric way? Well, let's see what he said. He said blacks smelled bad and were physically unattractive. Well, this was inconsistent with his behavior because, you know, he fathered slaves, Sally Hemings. So it didn't smell that bad, huh? Now, here's a more important one. He said we required less sleep. Now, that one's more interesting to me. Why would he need to, what dissonance was he feeling that he would need to believe that blacks required less sleep? Why? What did he do? You know, he owned slaves. So what do you think, how hard do you think he worked them? What was the work day for a slave? Sunrise to sunset. But do you have any empirical evidence, Joy? Can you prove that? Because you know, if you can't write, you know, count it and measure it, it didn't happen in European culture. Is that correct? You got to count it and measure it. How many of you have measurable objectives? Measurable outcomes. You better measure it. I don't care if you tell them. Can you tell your boss really, truly, at the end of the year, we're doing better now? I've been to work every single day I've watched, and I can guarantee you we're doing better. Is that going to fly? That would be no. That means you have to count it and measure it. And if you didn't count and measure, it didn't happen. So when you start looking at the notion of requiring less sleep, that's an interesting thing because I have to believe if I work you that hard. And boy, I got humbled when I found out how hard folks worked in the sugar plantations. Ooh-wee, I got humbled by how hard folks in the Caribbean were worked. But what I decided to do is I looked at the Library of Congress. Most of my work over the 9 years that it took to write the book, 6 years of that was research. The other part of it had to do with doing interviews of elders and reading slave narratives, and there are thousands of them. This is just one taken from the Library of Congress. Sarah Gudger from North Carolina wrote, "Never know nothing but work, never knew rest, felt like my back was going to break." Just the gospel truth. Then I looked at what happened in the sugar plantations, and this was amazing. One final set of grim numbers underlines the way slaves on sugar plantations like Codrington, which was a plantation in Barbados, were systematically worked to an early death. When slavery ended in the United States, slaves imported over the centuries had grown to a population of nearly 4 million. When it ended in the British West Indies, total slave imports of well over 2 million left a surviving slave population of only about 670,000. More than twice as many slaves were shipped to the island of Jamaica alone than all 13 North American colonies combined. The Caribbean was a slaughterhouse. In fact, the reason why there was more importation of slaves to these plantations is because they died so frequently. They were treated so badly, ate so poorly, that females never reached their menstrual cycles. They never actually started their menstrual cycles, so they couldn't reproduce, you see. And so many of them died, they had to import more. That's how treacherous was, you lazy black folks that you are. Isn't that ironic, though? What's so ironic is black people run from the shame of feeling like they're perceived as lazy. I mean, I live with that so much that when I would go to hotels, I would leave it cleaner. Because your mother, everybody's mother taught you, leave it cleaner than you found it. So black folks are so hypersensitive, I was cleaning up the hotel room. Because I wouldn't want anyone to think I'm dirty, right? Now, all the people in the audience that are of color, how much harder did your parents tell you you had to work to get to even? How much harder? You had to work twice as hard. Now, how come I knew that about you? How come I knew that? Think about it. And yet, at the same time, white people think we're lazy, you see? But we're so hypersensitive because of the shame. Right? And then our ancestors will work to death. To death. Recently they unearthed a slave cemetery. They unearthed actually a slave cemetery in New York City. It's on Wall Street, by the way, in the shadow of the bull. Unearthed a slave cemetery. And they still to this day they're struggling. They recently, you know, have done a lot in terms of commemoration. I went to the, it took me everything to get to it. They had it blocked off so you couldn't get to it. But they, because they didn't want to deal with it. You know, you can't just bulldoze a cemetery. So here in all these skyscrapers in the middle of it is this little cemetery. And there are slaves in that cemetery. More important than that was what the bones told us. Because, you know, now, you know, you got CSI. Hell, I can go in there and tell you what's going on now. You know, so with the CSI thing, now, they've discovered a little bit about the bones. And to me, the most phenomenal thing about the bones is what they told us about those people and how they live. Majority of the people in there were children, infants and children, high mortality, infant mortality rate. They even know what they died of. Died of malnutrition and starvation because they could tell by the rotting of the teeth and the jawline. So even though they most likely grew food, they weren't allowed to eat it. And then they found something even more peculiar that speaks to this idea of why he believed we required less sleep. They would show a large frame man, and they would find an injury where the muscle actually detached itself from the bone as a result of exertion and not injury. Stay with me. It detaches itself from the bone as a result of exertion. That means you work so hard, the muscle detached itself from the bone. You don't see those kind of injuries in contemporary society because no one's going to work that hard. Unless, of course, you have a gun trained on you from sunrise to sunset. So we do have empirical evidence of how hard folks worked. Then he went on to say that we were dumb, cowardly, and incapable of feeling grief. Why would Thomas Jefferson need to believe that? Why would he need to believe we didn't feel grief? What was he doing, do you think, that produced cognitive dissonance? You were killing people? Not only were you killing people, beating them, you were selling them, yes? Selling mothers away from their children and husbands away from wives. And surely they don't feel it. Because if they felt it, that would make them human like me. So I simply say, and you see, it's not even so much that he said it, but he was an important person. If Joe, nobody said it, but he said it. So what do you think the rest of the folks, uneducated laborers, believed? Well, they don't feel grief, you know. After all, Thomas Jefferson says they don't. So he becomes a critical person in making those statements. But you see, it was all to relieve and to settle the conscience that he died with. But these become very important as you see how these things move forward. Then there was J. Marion Sims. I won't spend a lot of time with him. He's another figure. You can Google him. There's a statue, actually, of him in Central Park. And J. Marion Sims was an individual credited. He was the father of modern gynecology. How many women in here know what a vaginal speculum is? And for those men in the room that we lost, a vaginal speculum is a device designed to open up the vagina. It was considered one of the most important advancements in medicine that was made. He was credited as being the wealthiest physician to have ever lived. And what's interesting about him, you know, look at the medals pinned on him. I was just very curious about how it was they regarded this man, because no one ever really looked at how did he come up with that vaginal speculum. The way he did it was he actually did experiments on unanesthetized slave women. He created a makeshift hospital in his backyard in the mid-1800s. He built the first vaginal speculum from a pewter spoon. And he reasoned that slave women were able to bear great pain, meaning we don't need any anesthesia, because their race made them more durable and thus they were well suited for painful medical experimentation. We didn't even, you know, because we didn't feel like other women could feel. This man would cut into them, and just said, well, since they're black, they don't really feel it. Unbelievable. And more importantly is what he did to infants. Because not only did he experiment on women, he also experimented on infants. He said that black infants suffered from something he called trimus nascentium, which is now commonly referred to as neonatal tetanus. Neonatal tetanus originates in horse manure, which was the likely cause of the disease in slave infants. He attributed it to the indecency and intellectual flaws of slave infants, together with skull malformations at birth. That is a Shoemaker's awl. And that's an 1800s Shoemaker's awl. He would stick that into the heads of brand new infants in an effort to realign their skulls based on the indecency and intellectual flaws of their parents to treat the malady. Of course, it was 100% death rate. But that's what he would stick in the head of a baby at birth. And so these are things that are so horrific that you can't possibly wrap your head around it. And this man is, I mean, just Google him. And you think to myself, I think to myself, if I were up here in front of you right now, and this is going to become very important as you move, I move into the other slides. If I stomped a puppy to death out here, up here, just a little puppy, and stomped it right here to death in front of you, most of you would need therapy. And I would be arrested probably faster than killing a black man for killing a puppy. How could you do that? Do you realize how much dissonance you have to remove in order to stick that into the brain of a child? More importantly, the child can no longer be human. Are you understanding what I'm saying? The reason why he could do it is they weren't human. They didn't even feel pain. That's what this man believed. Now, you may look at that and go, those are horrific things from the past. There is a book out right now, not table reading. It's called Medical Apartheid. This is written by Harriet Washington, came out last year. This book chronicles the experimentation on black people up to contemporary day. See, we want to look at the Tuskegee experiments. We want to look at Sims and go, oh, that just still going on. Implicated, Harvard, Johns Hopkins, because we weren't what? Human. So that dehumanization is something that we really got to appreciate went on for a long time. Can you go back? Back one more. No white could ever rape a slave woman. The regulations of law as to the white race on the subject of sexual intercourse do not and cannot, for obvious reasons, apply to slaves. Their intercourse is promiscuous. We've now justified raping black women because they can't be raped. We aren't raping them. They're promiscuous by nature. So we can't do it. Forward, one more. The fact that white men could profit from raping their female slaves does not mean that their motive was economic. The rape of slave women by their masters was primarily a weapon of terror that reinforced whites' domination over their human property. Rape was an act of physical violence designed to stifle black women's will to resist and to remind them of their servile status. These become important instruments that you look at. And I want to give you some statistics as it relates to American history. By the mid-1800s, there was over 600,000 mixed-race children born. 600,000. How many of you know what miscegenation is? Miscegenation is an illegal marriage between people of different races. Actually, it was very profound here. That it was illegal to marry someone of another race. So when you consider the fact that one of the greatest issues and one of the number one reasons why black men were lynched, beaten, and imprisoned had to do with the fear that they were going to rape whom? White women. Now the numbers, I mean, we're talking about pure numbers, numbers alone. It was who being raped? Okay, it was black women being raped, but they can be raped. Let's advance forward. Before we get into the Casual Killing Act, the Casual Killing Act was written because of the number of people who were killed while being corrected. Okay. And if any slave resists his master, owner, or other person by his or her order, correcting such slave and shall happen to be killed in such correction, it shall not be counted felony, but the master, owner, and every other person so giving correction shall be acquitted of all punishment and accusation for the same as if such accident had never happened. So that means that if you happen to be correcting someone and you beat them to death, you know how hard it is to beat someone to death? I mean, I thought about that. I said it happened so frequently that they created a law so that you wouldn't feel any what? No guilt, because you were simply correcting them. Wasn't your fault. So I went back to look at who was beating folks to death. I wanted to know. And it was white women. White women were beating black children to death. That's who was being beaten to death. But it wasn't her fault. She was just correcting them. You see, what we do is we rob ourselves of our own humanity when we refuse to look at this stuff. We rob ourselves of our humanity. And that's what people didn't know happened. Going forward, one more. Then you had the mental health folks. This is how we got in. We got in to try to fix it. In the early years of the 19th century, a physician named Samuel A. Cartwright argued that two particular forms of mental illness caused by nerve disorders were prevalent among slaves. One was drapetomania, which was diagnosable by a single symptom, the uncontrollable urge to escape from slavery. So now what we've done is we've now pathologized your desire to be free. Must be something wrong with them. Keep trying to free themselves. And again, it would be funny if it weren't in journals. You see, all of this is to remove the cognitive dissonance. Now we have, look at all the people joining in. You got Linnaeus, you got anthropology, you got physicians. All of them saying, they deserve it. It's not us. We don't need to adjust anything. And if they just tried harder, how about you people just pull yourselves up from your bootstraps? What's the matter with you? The playing field has been leveled. Well, we're going to see if, in fact, it's been leveled. Or is that conjecture? Move forward. Now, I want you to look at this photo very closely, and I want you to see who's in it. More important than the man hanging, because you got to understand the lynchings that occurred in America happened after slavery, not during. Thousands of lynchings happened after slavery because this is a reaction to white fear of what we would do once freed. But we didn't create a vigilante group to take out white people, but they did create a vigilante group to take us out now that we're free. See, that happened after slavery. They were called the what? The Ku Klux Klan. They don't wear hoods anymore. They wear suits. But they're alive and well all over the world, even here. So look at who's in the picture. I want you to look at this little girl in particular. You can't see her closely, but she's actually grimacing, like smirking. Now, remember, let's go back to the puppy concept here. She would be loathed and torn up probably if this was a puppy, which means he's less than that. Because she's not disturbed. This little girl is not disturbed by this. But she should be, shouldn't she? People always ask me, they go, Joy, what was the impact on white people? There it is. Right there. Can't feel any empathy for him. None, zero, zip. There's a little one back here, even smaller. Because whatever she's been taught or told, socialized to believe, makes him no longer human. That's the greatest danger to white people, is that they can't feel it. And there's a reason why white people can't feel what we're talking about. My God, what would you then feel? It's tough. So I've got to believe, oh, it's all over now. It's not my fault. I don't benefit. It's not a big deal. Let's move on. It's not all of those things. But we don't say that to Jewish people. I dare you. But you have to understand, when you unearth this one, that's what we did to our children. Let's move forward. This is a similar photo to the one that is used in Denzel's movie. Now, and again, most important, this is a man that's being burned. Also, I won't read the depiction, but there are newspaper accounts of this. It's written in a book called 100 Years of Lynching by Ginsberg. No pictures, just newspapers that say not only did they burn him, they decapitated him, cut him into pieces, and used parts of his body as things to put on mantles. So people would say, get me a tongue, would you, or a liver, a little crisp, so I could put it on the mantle. Now, again, I want you to look at the folks. I want you to look at who's here. We're not talking about the toothless big gut hooded wonder, are we? We're looking at plain old common dressed up folks. They're squeezing, please, I want my picture taken. Are you following me? This is somebody's cousin, uncle, somebody. And the ability to do that, dehumanize this man and rob them of their humanity all at the same time. All at the same time. That is the most dangerous, treacherous thing that could happen. What did Hitler do? He dehumanized human beings, put babies in ovens. Anything that robs us of our humanity is a danger to everyone. And that is what's going on with people of African descent all over the world, because not only did it get done here, but who do we tell the entire world we told these people don't deserve any value? Everyone wants to be American, not y'all. But when we go, I mean, I literally go to countries all over the world. America sets the standard, and thank God for what happened later. Let's move forward. So a lot of people start saying, well, y'all got free, right? Y'all are free. Everything's fine. Because see, whenever you talk about post-traumatic slave syndrome, people get locked there. So there's a myth that after slavery ended, the playing field was leveled. Was it? Remember, all the lynchings occurred after slavery. That wasn't during, after slavery. So, you had black sharecropping. Now, we didn't get a lot of black history in our schooling. I have 4 degrees, and 3 of them advanced degrees. Never did I get black history. I got about 2 pages of black history, and one page was a picture. And it was a picture of the little folks with the cabin. You probably saw the same picture. It's a little cabin. The little guy on the porch with the banjo, little children running, frolicking about, eating watermelon, right? Everybody happy? And we certainly need little Mary and little Johnny to believe that they were happy. The slaves were happy people. And they had a nice place to live. Because we couldn't have them feeling cognitive what? Not little Mary. She can't start questioning what Grandpa did. So I want you to see this, because those are leftover slave quarters. He's a sharecropper. So now let's go back and take a look at sharecropping. Now, these are folks that were slaves, no longer slaves, decided I'm going back to be a sharecropper on the same plantation that I was enslaved. Why would you do that? Let's move forward. Here's why. Because when you did try to leave, and you go north because you're free. I want you to go north now. I live in Oregon, right? That's where I live. Here we go. No free Negro mulatto not residing in this state at the time of the adoption of this Constitution shall come reside or be within this state or hold any real estate or make any contracts or maintain any suit therein. And the legislative assembly shall provide by penal laws for the removal by public officers of all such Negroes and mulattoes, and for their effectual exclusion from the state, and for the punishment of persons who shall bring them into the state or employer harbor them. This was repealed November 3rd, 1926. My father was alive. Section 6, that if any free Negro mulatto shall fail to quit the country as required by this act, if guilty upon trial, shall receive upon his or her back not less than 20, no more than 39. We'll beat you. That if any free Negro mulatto shall fail to quit the country within the term of 6 months after receiving such stripes, he or she shall again receive the same punishment over once every 6 months until he or she shall quit the country. We're going to beat you till you leave. But you're free. The playing field is leveled. Pull yourself up from your bootstraps. Are you following me? So he went back to the plantation. Let's go back. He went back to the plantation to be a sharecropper because that's the only place he could live. But he can't read or write because it was illegal to educate a slave. So I'm illiterate. I go back and I say to the slave owner, who past slave owner, okay, now I'm coming back to work for a fair wage because I'm free. And the slave owner says, sure, you can come back. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to advance you seed, tool, and a mule. In other words, you know, I am going to give you that grant that you want. And we're going to let you work with that. And at the end of the year, we'll settle up. Well, the grant's never enough, is it? And so at the end of the year, he's found owing. And what must he do to pay off that debt? He's got to work it off, yes? And his children have to work it off, yes? That's called debt servitude or another form of slavery. But you all are free. What are you whining about? Let's move forward. Move forward. So, well, can we lease them? Now everybody wants to know, big issue. You have overrepresentation here. Guess how I know. Overrepresentation in the criminal justice system as its ideology. It was big business then. It's big business now. You're going to get free labor one way or another. New slavery is imprisonment. Well, let's see. Why was this? It was so successful. By the mid-1898, nearly three-quarters of Alabama's total state revenue came directly from this institution. Well, of course, I wanted to do research on what they did, because they're free. But now we're arresting them at alarming rates. And for what? 12 years for vagrancy, loitering, startling a white woman, looking menacingly at a white woman. That's what they got 10, 12, 15 years for. And many of them, 25%, died under convict lease, more than during slavery, because there were no protections, because now we have another label to justify our behavior towards them. And what's their new label? Well, after all, they're convicts. They're criminals. Don't they deserve it? Do you see what I'm saying? So when did it end, is the question. Move forward. You all heard about Katrina, yes? Yeah. See, I was there. My family's from Louisiana. I went to the Ninth Ward. Sometimes you can't pay attention to what the news says. It's important to actually go eyeball what's going on, which was very interesting, because it was one of the most horrific events I'd ever seen and probably will ever see in my life. Well, black folks were just simply treated differently. Did you notice that? Here's the good news about Katrina. Everybody noticed it. So all the rest of the world, where we learn, send us your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, your democracy, your equality. They said, what happened with that Katrina thing? All that stuff y'all talked about. Well, let me read this. This is from Associated Press, taken straight from the newspaper. In the front, actually, the top part here is actually a woman, but they think it's a man. Anyway, it says, a young man walks through chest-deep floodwater after looting a grocery store in New Orleans on Tuesday, August 30th, 2005. Same body of water down here, excuse me. Two residents wade through chest-deep water after finding bread and soda from a local grocery store. Now, same event, same water. White people, black people. We've told you what you see now. That removes your what? Dissonance, because these people can't be perceived as looting. They're white people. White people don't loot. Now, the truth of the matter is, I don't care what any of them are doing. It doesn't matter, but I'm going to still the social conscience by letting you know, don't forget, this is a looter. Matter of fact, what you last heard was that they were looters and rapists. Did you not? So don't they deserve it? That wasn't back in, slavery, though, was it? Now we're going to kind of move into operationalizing that to look at what is it, how do we begin to connect that behavior, that history, to what we're dealing with and what you're dealing with right now and what we're seeing. And very often people say, well, is everything post-traumatic slave syndrome? Obviously that would, trivialize all the work. You know, we cannot lay squarely on the shoulders of post-traumatic, all the problems that we see, nor can we place all the problems squarely on the shoulders of white people or any of the above. So hopefully we won't digress into anything that is that foolish in terms of a discussion. Because, that's another thing that happens in terms of trying to deal with the pushback around this. Then we move into extremes, and it tends to dilute the realities that are going on. So hopefully we're way beyond all that. Well, now she's saying everything is post-traumatic. No, I'm not. And most of my work, my background is really in the field, doing doing work in the community and grassroots. That's where my training was in terms of my clinical work. And just, you know, the fact that I've always been, this work started on the ground. It didn't start here. Matter of fact, I got the attention of places like Oxford and Harvard and, you know, the Ivy League and major institutions, even the FBI, you know. But those were things that happened after I started doing the work on the grassroots level. And so it's, for me, my commitment is to healing. So this is not an exercise in some kind of broad intellectual esoteric. It's really about how do we then take this information and help a person extricate themselves from behavior that they've learned and or been socialized to believe black and white and everyone in the middle that's been affected by this. What do we do? So this is kind of looking at the contemporary kind of reflection of the trauma. Which is white supremacy and terrorism. That continues. We see that on a daily basis in the United States as well as here. This book is called Breaking Rank by Norm Stamper. Norm Stamper is a 34-year police veteran. He was a chief of police for the cities of San Diego and Seattle. This is a white man wrote this book called Breaking Rank, and he really did. So all I can tell you is he broke rank. I've been trying to meet Norm. Norm travels quite a bit, and he gets a considerable amount of death threats because of what he's done. But he talked about, and this is contemporary. And remember, that's what we're looking at. How does it reflect itself today? I've heard some police officers refer to prostitute slayings or to the slayings of blacks as misdemeanor murders, employing an unofficial code for them, NHI, which means no human involved. Now, these are on telephone calls. These are on calls that you hear on police officers speaking. Hey, what do you have? Well, we have an NHI. We have no human involved. It's the black person killed. You see what I'm saying? Again, the dehumanization reflecting itself in just their casual involvement with one another. San Diego cops confessed to a myriad other acts of discrimination, including additionally dehumanizing the references to blacks on a radio call, just an 1113 nigger. 1113 is a code for an injured animal. How many people think they understand what racism is? Show of hands. Come on, you know, you think you know. I'm not suggesting I know. I just have a couple of definitions that that kind of came to me as I thought about it. How many people think there are white racists? That there are white racists out there? How many think there are black racists out there? Okay. Now, this is an interesting thing because this becomes important as we begin to define concepts. Now, I do that. I usually define concepts all the way. But one of the things that I do is I try to help people get a picture of what I mean by racism. So tell me how it is. I'm going to first category is white racism, then we'll deal with black racism. So white racism. Tell me the ways in which white racism adversely impacts the lives of black people. Just what are the ways that white racism can adversely impact the lives of black people as a group? What are some of those ways? I'm sorry? Power, but how is that defined specifically? Education, okay. I'm sorry? Economically, employment. What else? Housing, what else? Policing, why are we here today? Healthcare, okay. Now, we could actually kind of grow that list. Now we're going to move over to black racism. Tell me the ways in which black racism adversely impacts the lives of white people as an entire group. Thank you. The reason why you become silent, there's one that always comes up, and that's fear. White people are afraid of black people. They are afraid of us. And it's a very interesting thing because black people know it. We know white people are afraid. But you have to start getting into the psychology. What are you afraid of? Why are you afraid? But it's an interesting dynamic. Now, also you see the difference in what racism is, do you not? Racism implies you have not just prejudice, but the power to do something with that prejudice. Now, I don't like you, not only that, but I'm going to control whether you can get, you know, I may say I hate you. I hate white people. I hate them. I hate them. It's not going to change you getting that, you know, loan when you go to the bank. You could go, you can hate, I can hate you all the way to the bank. Not going to change. Do you see the difference? That whereas white racism says, not only do I not like you, but I'm going to change the impact of where you can live. I'm going to determine with that racism where your powers are. You following me? And I'm talking about as a group, not an individual, because people said, I remember when my uncle didn't. I'm not talking about your uncle. I'm talking about the whole group. I'm not talking about an incident. That's a difference. But white people are afraid. So let's get into how this fear impacts criminal justice. Because if white people in this room are afraid of black people, guess who else is afraid of black people? Only they have guns. So now let's look at what he said. Simply put, white cops are afraid of black men. We don't talk about it. We pretend it doesn't exist. We claim color blindness. We say white officers treat black men the same way they treat white men. But that's a lie. And here's a big one. In fact, the bigger, the darker the black man, the greater the fear. Any big black men in here? You got a big old bullseye on you, even if you got the suit on. And it's the truth, because we statistics bear it out. The African community knows this. Hell, most whites know it. Yet even though it's a central, if not the defining ingredient in the makeup of police racism, white cops won't admit it to themselves or to others. He goes on to talk about actually learning it in the academy. Norm Stamper, he told on everybody. He had folks indicted. He now lives in a cabin on a mountain somewhere in the San Juan Islands. That's where he lives. Nobody knows where he lives because he knows they're coming after him, and they have. This is a statement from the book also. Race and class discrimination are all too real in every phase of the criminal justice system, from arrest to sentencing. Impoverished black defendants, and this is going to sound familiar to you, are far more likely to wind up on death row than richer middle-class whites, or the 3,000, and of the 3,700 inmates now awaiting execution nationwide, 43% are African-American. Black defendants are not accorded the same due process rights as whites. Their cases are not given the same scrutiny and consideration afforded to white defendants. Not now, not ever, not in this country. This is what the man said. It was dismal. But he doesn't believe it's possible in the current system. So what we have to realize, we need to be realistic about that. So what I have to do is teach my sons how to navigate this, do I not? Doesn't matter what I think, and no, baby, you know, we are the world. No, this is real. You do have a bullseye on you. When you're in the elevator with the only white woman there, and you're the big black man, she's clutching her purse and she's worried. That's a reality. And if you startle her too much, it used to mean you get lynched. Matter of fact, I think she could scream rape now and you'd get taken down. Now, this is interesting because this has to do with women. You know, my father used to say if a white man has a cold, a black man has pneumonia. And if a black man has pneumonia, a black woman has cancer. It just kind of figures out that way. In 1986, on-duty California Highway Patrol officer Craig Payer strangled a San Diego State University student named Kara Knott and threw her body off a 70-foot bridge. Motive, she'd resisted his sexual advances. Now, let's go back and understand that, and this is an interesting thing. I worked with adolescent and adult male and female prostitutes for 5 years. I don't want you to get that confused. I'm not an ex-ho. I've actually had people say, gosh, she's come along. You know, she used to be. She's done so well. So somehow when I say that, people think I've never been in the life. Okay, I work with adolescent, adult, male and female prostitutes as a case manager counselor. Okay, and during that time that I worked with folks, it was very interesting to see the perspectives and the behaviors and the attitudes that people had about prostitutes. I mean, when folks want to be, if you want to start off as a serial killer, just go kill the prostitutes. Nobody cares. They don't even CSI don't investigate the prostitute slayings, right? But when we begin to see what's been happening with particularly women of color, you know, just historically, women of color have been fodder for white men. Now, what started in the backwoods or in the cabin with the slaves it never went away, you know. And I want to speak to this because this is a tough one to swallow too. But imagine they did a study back in the 80s, and they asked men across the board, across races, if you could get away with sexually assaulting a woman, raping a woman, in other words, and there's no possible way that you'll get, you know, penalized for it. Do you ever get, would, how many of you would consider doing it? This is just regular Joe, go to work with the kids, 70%, 70, said if I could do it, I would do it. Imagine being able to do that for a couple hundred years with impunity. Imagine, you don't have to worry about, you know, you talk about pedophilia and all that. Imagine being able to buy that. And then you could beat it to death, too, and get another one. I know it's tough to wrap your head around, but what happens to an appetite created like that? Where you could rape a black woman anytime you wanted to, and it wasn't considered rape because she was promiscuous. Hundreds of years. We're not talking about a few years. Hundreds of years protected by the law. No moral. You could go to church. It was all good. Where do you think that went after slavery ended? It didn't go away because guess who's the number one? You got folks who are pimping the women, and then you got the ones that are buying them. And who's buying them? Same middle-aged white males between 35 and 60 married with children. 5 years I work with them. These are the Johns. Still are the Johns. And still are getting hold of some of that black body. Are you following me? This is really important. No, it just mutated into something else. So now we have to figure out a way within the legal perspective to deal with these women who are out of control. My cautious guess is that 5% of America's cops are on the prowl for women. Women, you need to get concerned. 5% of any police department. In other words, they're folks who become police officers because they're predatory. That's why. Think about it. We know where pedophiles go, don't we? You go where there are children. Thank you. So we got to understand, police officers, plenty of them are twisted. And I've worked for the last 20 years with police officers. Trust me. I'm always concerned about someone that deliberately wants a gun, aside from the short man. In a department the size of Seattle, that's 63 police officers. In San Diego, 145. In New York City, 2,000. The average patrol cop makes anywhere from 10 to 20 unsupervised contacts a shift. If he's on the make, chances are a predatory cop will find you or your wife, your partner, your daughter, your sister, your mother, your friend. That's in general. And you see, you get a freebie when you have a person of color because they have no rights. It is not hard to understand why people of color, the poor, and younger Americans did not and do not look upon the police as, quote, theirs. Compare and contrast. Are the police as an institution known for their protection of the innocent against deception, or do they deceive the innocent? Do the police protect the weak against oppression or intimidation, or do they oppress and intimidate the very people they've sworn to protect? Again, we're not talking about anybody that just fell off a truck. We're talking about a 34-year police veteran who went back, by the way, to get his PhD. Now, this was a study I did, the research I did. Now, let me explain kind of the basis of this research. 200 African-American male youth, 100 of whom are incarcerated, right? 100 of whom are not, but are from the same neighborhood. That was my the group that I was working with. So one of the things that I wanted to do, over here on the right side, what you see is my dependent variable, what I'm trying to predict. And what I'm trying to predict is the use of violence. So what I discovered was the most significant predictor of African-American adolescent violence, when I did the multiple, in other words, I put all the variables together to see out what was most significant. The baseline variables are witnessing and victimization. We already know they're going to fall out because they're baseline. We already know that with respect. The most important predictor, respect. Think about that. How do you get respect as African-American male, period, but a male youth, 16, in your society? How does he get respect? Got to get it, though. because he's not going to roll up in a corner and bawl and die somewhere. He needs to get respect. And as black people, I say this all the time out in here, that we can ill afford to swallow whole what is called cultural. We can ill afford to swallow that because there's poison in the cookies. And the only way to get the poison out of the cookies is not someone from the outside looking in, but those who are living in this to be able to look at themselves and assess it with a level of dignity, a level of safety that perpetuates a sense of well-being and healing. Thank you so much.
Looking menacingly at a white woman. Vagrancy, loitering, 10, 15 years for that. Here's the kicker. 25% of people under convict lease died. More than during slavery, because you don't kill off your property that you need to work for you. But they didn't have any protections because they have another label, do they not? And when you're going to oppress the subjugated people, what must you do? You must justify by relabeling them, but not only are they black, genetically inferior, lustful, careless, governed by caprice, but now they're criminals, which then justifies what we do. So 25% of them died under convict leasing. But look at how lucrative it was. Convict leasing was so successful that by 1898, nearly three-quarters of Alabama's total state revenue came directly from this institution. So then the trauma continued. But y'all free, right? Let's move on. So then we had, oh Lord, we got it now. Separate but equal. Is it equal now, friends? Still separate, though. You know where the Negroes are? Well, we're doing gentrification in Portland, but you know. We know where the black folk are, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
You know where to find them, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's no, you know, sign on the freeway that says next left hood. But we know when we're there, don't we?
Keep it real.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Separate, never equal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's contemporary, right? Now we're going to get to the hot where am I in time. You don't have a concept of that. Where are we? Where's the time person? Where am I in time?
You got 25
minutes. Excellent. So I wanted to endeavor to look at some of the more difficult pieces because I really wanted to take a look at some things that, I tell you, this moves into chapter 3. I need to talk about J. Marion Sims. Could you find his picture? J. Marion. Yes, he came earlier. He cleans up nice. J. Marion Sims, let me tell you a little bit about Jay. How many people, you know him, you know. There are huge statues, edifices for this man. Great thing. How many people in the room know what a vaginal speculum is? For those young men or men in the room that we brought you there, what a vaginal speculum is, it's an instrument that was created to open up the vagina so folks could kind of peer in. Now, J. Marion Sims is the individual credited with that creation, and he is touted as being the wealthiest physician to have ever lived. J. Marion Sims was a physician in the mid-1800s, credited with the creation of the first vaginal speculum, which he made from a pewter spoon. Sims had built a makeshift hospital in his backyard where he conducted surgical experiments on unanesthetized African slave women. Sims reasoned that slave women were able to bear great pain because their race made them more durable and thus they were well suited for painful medical experimentation. So this is someone who took an oath to do no harm. And he cut into black women without any anesthesia. Now let me kind of get close with you around why this becomes very important. J. Marion Sims becomes very important because the first question I asked was, first of all, where do all the women come from? How do you get them? And what the problem was is it would be said that these women were not fit for duty by their slave masters. And here's why they weren't fit for duty. Many of the women suffered from what was called a fistula. An obstetric fistula is the breakdown of tissue in the vaginal wall, frequently as a result of childbirth, which affects the bladder and or the rectum. The disorder causes leakage of urine and feces into the vagina, which made for a smelly and humiliating existence for the women. However, this condition did not preclude these slave women from participating in their daily work on the plantation, such as picking cotton, house cleaning, cooking, etc. So what duty were the women then unfit for? The obvious answer is that while black slave women were required to do manual labor alongside their black male counterparts, one of their other inescapable duties was to sexually serve their slave masters. Their malodorous condition made them less sexually desirable, and thus they were unfit for duty. So you need to clean them up, Mary and Sam, so we can do them. But what's more important about this is how we justify. Remember, in order to oppress or subjugate, you have to justify that behavior. But it wasn't only the women that suffered under his reign. Could you show the all, please? Slave women were not the only group to suffer. Black infants represent the most innocent of Sims' victims. Black infants suffered from what he termed trimus nascentium, now commonly referred to as neonatal tetanus. Tetanus originates in horse manure. The likely cause of the disease enslaved infants, given their living condition and their proximity to animal stables. Sims attributed the condition to the indecency and intellectual flaws of the black slaves, together with skull malformations at birth. Sims attempted to treat this malady by trying to pry the bones in the skulls of the tiny infants into alignment with a shoemaker's awl. I was careful to find one from the 1800s. He would stick that into the brain and the skulls of black infants at birth in an effort to realign their skulls because of the indecency of their parents. He is worshipped in this medical world, J. Mary Sims. But I was more curious about how a physician could do such a thing. And here's how you do it. You pathologize the people. Now, let me read what they said about black women, because it gets real specific, black women. Their first pathological symptom was their skin color. In a medical world that categorized life as either normal or pathological, people of the African diaspora were continually condemned to the category of pathological, their abnormal skin serving as a foil for normal white skin. Stay with me. The skin, if you see black people, the problem is the skin itself is pathological because it's actually a foil over normal white skin. This is what medical journals suggested. Now we're going to find out how they named it. Medical tradition has a long history of perceiving this skin color as a form of pathology. The favorite theory, which reappears with some frequency in the early 19th century, is that the skin color, an attendant physiognomy of the black, here's the reason why y'all black, is because of congenital leprosy. This is why there's so many of us. We all have congenital leprosy. Now, we have a second symptom. The second symptom of pathology was gender. Black females were perceived to be irreligious, lustful, and immoderate. Well, that's convenient, isn't it? Let's take a look at that. We need to really take a look at this one, because I have a whole chapter on rape. Can't even get close to what that did to me. There were over, and this comes out of a social work book. In a social work book, it states that there were over 600,000 mixed-race babies born in the mid-1800s, based on the census. Now, this was during miscegenation. That means it's illegal to marry. So who was sneaking out back, and who was raping whom? We have numbers. Young girls rarely made it to their teens before they were raped. But let's put that in perspective as a social scientist. Now, I want to get into that, to the fact that we were lustful, because then you see it's their fault, isn't it? Surely I raped them, but didn't they deserve it? Now we need evidence of how we know they're lustful and immoderate and immoral. Here we go. Their protruding buttocks and genitals were offered as physical evidence of their pathology. Anybody up there with a big butt? Anybody with a big butt out there? There you have it, you slut. It's incredulous. It's hard for you to even believe it. We see it in books. And the criminally insane, right. But what was so amazing, I want to get right, let's get right up with that one, because the butt thing really threw me off. Because everybody wants that butt now, don't they?
Yeah.
J-Lo made it, gave us all permission to first have the butt, and it's an African butt, don't get confused about it. And it's a butt they couldn't keep their hands off of. Now they're injecting the butt now. They're putting butts in pants. They're making underwear with a butt in. In addition to that, injecting the lips with collagen,
yeah.
Locking the hair and telling you the whole time you're ugly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Still looking for the safest tan. Isn't that amazing?
Mm-hmm.
And the sad thing about it is we believe we're ugly.
Mm-hmm.
Case in point, 2006. Oh yeah, she was cute. She had good hair.
Mm.
Yeah, she had good hair. He was fine. He was light skinned.
Yeah.
Look at a music video. Same girl, isn't it? We might as well just take him over and over again. Tragic Mulatto. Are you following me? I have people say, well, Joy, are you going natural? Going natural? I mean, you even have blood to go, wow, she's militant. And that's because I actually wear my hair the way it grows out of my head.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody white in here, everybody go, you're not going to keep it like that, are you? You're going to perm it or something, aren't you? You're not going to just wear it like that, right? I can see your roots, girl. White people don't do that to white people. We have pathologized what is naturally us. And when we would want to assault or insult you black, big lip, nappy head, stay with me.
Mm-hmm.
You see, that's called post-traumatic slave syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
That's what that looks like. And then white people go, well, no wonder, look at them. They're so negative. Right? So let's move on. So then after all that, I want to take a look at another piece, because again, you know, when you think of someone that raped and did horrible things, you get the picture of a big gut toothless wonder. You know, a straw hat and, you know, get the boys and go on out there and get them. Well, let's just move and start looking at the impact the strange fruit has. You all know a strange fruit. Billy got in trouble for recording that one. But let's talk about the strange fruit. And this isn't in the book, by the way. I didn't put ugly pictures in the book. I'm not interested in re-injuring black people. But I want you to look at this picture, and there's only one reason why I want you to look at it, is I want you to look at who's in it.
Mm-hmm.
This is just plain old regular folk. And the way that little girl is looking at that man,
mm-hmm.
she can't be right. That's what's wrong with white people, by the way. It's right there in that picture. Because, see, no one talked about what happened to white people. That's another book. But this is specifically, I show this picture because it's unbelievable. Got the little Sunday band. They ran train excursions and let children out of school early to attend lynchings. Lynchings. Now, let's show the other slide because I want to read this one. It's a rather gruesome one. I want to get you prepared. But I want to read from this one so you can understand what they did at the lynchings. If you want to know the reference to this, you can. I have a reading list in my book. In addition to that, you can go on site on my line online with my my website joyleary.com, and it'll give you some suggested readings. The name of the book that I would suggest are two. One is called 100 Years of Lynching. They're all newspaper accounts. That's by Ginsberg. 100 Years of Lynching. No pictures. This one is a famous picture that you will find in a variety of places, but one of them is called Without Sanctuary, recently published, which is a pictorial. And now what I'm doing is I'm going to read from the newspaper account. Before the torch was applied, the Negro was deprived of his ears, fingers, and genital parts of his body. He pleaded pitifully for his life while the mutilation was going on, but stood the ordeal of fire with surprising fortitude. Before the body was cool, it was cut to pieces, the bones were crushed into small bits, and even the tree upon which the wretch met his fate was torn up and disposed of as souvenirs. The Negro's heart was cut into several pieces, as was also his liver. Those unable to obtain the ghastly relics direct paid their more fortunate possessors extravagant sums for them. Small pieces of bone went for 25 cents, and a bit of the liver, crisply cooked, sold for 10 cents. As soon as the Negro was seen to be dead, there was a tremendous struggle among the crowd to secure the souvenirs. Knives were quickly produced, and soon the body was dismembered. Now I want you to look at who's in the picture. They're crowding to be in it, in suits. So whatever memory or thoughts we had about who these folks were, they were just plain common folk. But Joy, surely, you know, this has no relevance today. Between 1882 and 1967, 200 bills, and Senator Ava Gordley wouldn't know about this one, 200 bills were presented before Congress to outlaw lynching. Additionally, seven presidents urged Congress to end the practice. Each and every time these efforts were rejected by the Congress, and lynchings continued unabated and unpunished. It was not until 2005 that the U.S. Senate offered an apology for what it termed domestic terrorism against mostly black people. And even then, folks wouldn't sign on it. So did the trauma continue? Boy, we're an amazing people. We're an amazing people. But we don't know who we are. And you cannot heal what you don't understand. We can't heal it if we won't look at it. So how does it manifest itself? Very quickly, let me go through some of my research, because I'm going to give you some examples of it. There's a chart, and I did work specifically on African-American male youth violence. I didn't want to look at violence, by the way. What I really wanted to look at was something I term in the book vacant esteem, one of the symptoms of post-traumatic slave syndrome. Vacant esteem should not be somehow confused with low self-esteem. Low self-esteem is when you can't do as many chin-ups as maybe your sister or your brother. I'm not talking about that. And I don't think esteem should be measured in terms of low and high, because there are people with perfectly high self-esteem that are assholes. And you have to go to meetings with them, don't you? But they have high self-esteem. They ain't right, though. So I think esteem should be measured in terms of accurate esteem. Accurate esteem. Do you have an assessment of yourself that is appropriate? Not high or low, accurate, and healthy. So these are things I looked at. I don't want to look at this. I told you, I don't want to look at violence. Why? Because my committee told me that vacant esteem wasn't a social problem. Clearly, that's not a social problem. A social problem, let me define it. Remember my graduate work. A social problem is a social problem, can be defined as a social problem if a significant number of people believe that it is a social problem. Or significant persons believe it is a social problem. And we didn't qualify for either of those, not black people. But let me tell you why I wanted to look at self-esteem. I wanted to look at self-esteem because my first work was with children. I saw things happening with black children that bothered me, disturbed me. Aside from the good hair, bad hair, and all the other ugly, negative black epithets that we would throw at one another that I heard in the contemporary world around me, I was concerned about what I saw happening to the hearts and minds of little black children. And one of the things that I started to notice happened directly after I had come from South Africa in 1994. I went to South Africa on the heels of the inauguration of Nelson Mandela. And it was a tough time in the country. And it was an incredible time for me, because it was, in fact, for me, in a way, a rebirth, a pilgrimage, a point of normalcy that I never knew. Because I never knew how to feel normal as a black person in America. This is an article recently published called, it says, "My Black Skin Makes My White Coat Vanish." This is a doctor who was standing in the lobby, and her clients would go, "Where's the doctor?" Right? We're invisible. And I grew up being invisible, discounted on a daily basis. So I went to Africa. It was the first time in my life it felt normal being black. And so I cried a lot. I cried so much, in fact, the eight of the women I was traveling with got a little through with me. Now, there's a reason why they got a little through with me. The reason they got a little through with me is because, see, in South Africa, in this southern region, actually I was in four countries, when you cry, you know, here they go, get that girl a tissue. Find a tissue, dry it up. In Africa, they sing. And they just start singing. Four-part harmony and breaking it off, right? And the whole room would just be singing until I stopped crying. And this was profound. The Queen of Lesotho had her royal choir come and sing to this group of 9 African-American women who were professionals traveling throughout the southern region. And this was really good and emotional, except there's a little catch. After they finished singing, they asked us to offer a few songs. And contrary to popular belief, we can't all sing. And so the women in my group were, you know, we did learn a few tunes, though. We were even on radio after a while. But my sister, who was traveling with me, we were on our way to Lesotho, actually, and they got up and they met without me, the women. And so when I woke up, my sister said, Joy, you know we're going to Lesotho today. I said, yeah. She goes, and Joy, we're not singing in Lesotho. So whatever you need to do, Joy, to get your little stuff together, we need you to do that because we're not singing in Lesotho. So I said, I'm good. Okay, I got it. Holding it down. So we all go to Lesotho, and when they have this meeting, the meeting is actually larger than this room, and people are coming from all over. We got people coming from villages, people coming from the government, everybody is coming to greet these 9 African-American women. So we're sitting on the stage. And, of course, things have to be translated. So the guy who's translating, he is actually a descendant of slaves that were enslaved by the Dutch in a place called Umfravat in South Africa. And Umfravat means the unexpected in Afrikaans. They were left to die after apartheid ended. But this man had gone back to learn the tribal language. So each one of us would get up and he'd translate. So I got up. I was the first one. All the women were looking at me glaring like, keep it together. So I got up there. I was good. I said, my name is Joy DeGruliere, and I'm traveling with, you know, and we're trying to build a corridor relationship with our African sisters. And I sat on down. I thought I did good. My sister, like, thumbs up. Everything's good. Translator gets up, starts translating. Then he starts going on and on and on and on and on. And people start chanting. And just, you know, so my sister looking back at me. So I leaned over. I said, "What'd you say?" He goes, "I told him what you said." I said, "I didn't say all that." He said, "Oh, what had happened was..." No, he said, "Well, when I got to the part where you said you were African American, some of the people from remote villages got confused because they thought all Americans were white. So then I had to explain to them that you were the descendants of the ones that had been stolen away, and they were saying to you, welcome home." So, you know, everybody was singing, because I was crying. I was showing. My sister looks at me. So everybody's on their feet singing. I'm tore up, stuff in the corner. So this black woman who was in the corner of the room walks all the way towards me, grabs me by the hand and said, "Did you think we would forget you? I am from Lesotho, and Lesotho is my home. If I leave Lesotho, Lesotho is still my home. If I leave Lesotho for 15 years, Lesotho is still my home. We mourned Malcolm and Martin with you. We are so, so very proud of you. You are African 300 years from home. We just wondered when you were coming back." And then I realized how much of me had been taken from me. So when I came home, I was a little depressed. To Portland, to the hood.
All right.
I was living on a knife, which is no longer the hood. But I was living on a knife, and folks would call and see if I was coming out. They were worried. People on the trip called, "What's wrong with her? She ain't out." So finally, one day I had to come out because my daughter ran in. She goes, "Mom, there's a little boy outside. He said he gonna beat up Nadeem, that's her brother, and he gonna pee on the car too." Which, as you know, could happen in the hood. So I had to go outside. So I go outside to find a cruel young black boy standing. Ain't nobody over 10. My son's trying to hold his own, but he's scared. I walk right over to the little ringleader, and I said, "Has my son done something that I need to know about?" "Yeah, I wanna know if he got some kind of eyeball problem." Not speaking about it, and that kind of went, "What did you say?" "I want to know if he got some kind of eyeball problem." what he's staring at. I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute, you want to beat my son up because he was looking at you? Now, I want you to contrast that, because in Africa, when they talk to you, when they would, you know how, this is what black folks do, everyone. don't we do that?
Mm-hmm.
My white people ask you, God, you have so many friends. But that's an acknowledgement. We walk down the street in the grocery and try not to acknowledge somebody. What, you too good? don't you know, you don't do that, because it's so important in African culture. Or in Africa, it's even a step further. They, in all the languages, it translates to meaning, I see you. And isn't that what we're doing when we do this?
Mm-hmm.
Now, we don't have a language anymore, but we kept that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I'm looking at this boy telling me that he going to beat my son into the ground because he was looking at him. I said, he could have been looking at you because he thought maybe you want to play a little basketball one-on-one. We got the hoop out here. He could have been looking at you because he could have maybe played a little video game. We got a little video game inside. He could have been looking at you because you know the park right down the street on 9th and Fremont. Maybe y'all could almost kick it. Right, so the little kids are looking at me like, whoa. You know, I got a little therapeutic on them. So, finally, I give them my spiel about how we have to keep ourselves safe in the community and how we have to protect one another and stand together. And then I remembered Africa. And Africa said, I see you. And Africans said, what you looking at? What? What? Well, let me put that in perspective for you, because that happens, doesn't it? Let me put this in perspective as it relates to this. This comes out of the article I wrote. And, of course, you can find this article. It's very important. The Journal of Social Work Research and Practice. And you can go on my site and download it as well. It's on African-American Adolescent Respect, the scale that I wrote. But I want to read this particular excerpt from it so you can put in perspective in contemporary society what I mean about that, what you're looking at. According to Anderson, respect is an essential part of street rules that are strictly enforced and regulated. Simply maintaining eye contact for too long may be viewed as a lack of respect and a front that can escalate into a confrontation. In a similar vein, a snide remark that might otherwise be viewed as trivial may lead to an honor contest. Boy, I wish I had more time to talk to you about that. Where no party backs down until someone is injured. This is taken from a book by Regine Persois. You can also find that in the book and on the website. This is a quote. On my way back from school, I saw a young brother on a crowded N train eating sunflower seeds. Between his legs laid a mound of wet, disgusting sunflower shells that he kept enlarging by spitting on the floor. Though visibly frustrated and disgusted by his behavior, no one would dare challenge his position. An older white man motioned to him to stop spitting the seeds on the floor. In response, he spat the seeds with much more animation than before, while effortlessly trying to stare fear into the old man. I made eye contact with him. And he said, what? What? Believe me, in the world of powerlessness, this is enough for a shootout. He leered at me, then said, I thought so. And I responded with my generation's favorite confrontation closer, whatever. Mm-hmm. Now we were both snaring, sneering, staring, flexing, profiling, and posturing at each other, refusing to yield the power we thought we had, creating two more powerless brothers in a confrontation over bullshit, two intellectual amputees looking for the upper hand while mentally handcuffed. That's today. That goes on. So I wanted to understand, what is the relationship with that contemporary behavior? And why did that little boy look at my son and feel so threatened by him looking at him? What must he have thought my son was seeing? Because based on what we know about Erickson's model of development, what we know about Piaget, what we understand about human development, is that I attain to my self-concept based upon the appraisal of significant others in my life. So I am not who I think I am, and I am not who you think I am. I am who I think that I am. So what did he think my son believed about him? What did he see peering back at him? He saw peering back what he hated in himself, and he was 10 years old. And I said, what has happened to this little boy that he cannot withstand the gaze? That he so hates the reflection in the mirror that he would destroy my son to destroy the image. That is post-traumatic slave syndrome. That's why I endeavored to look, and I didn't want to look at violence. I wanted to look at the internalized violence, but that wasn't a social problem. So then I looked at young men that hurt each other. So first on the left-hand side, you have stress variables. The first two variables are what we call baseline variables, violence witnessing and violence victimization. On the right-hand side, you have the dependent variable. In other words, I'm trying to predict this, and that is use of violence. I'm trying to see what the other variables have to do with the use of violence. So now those two baseline variables we already know produce violence. When people witness violence or experience being hurt, they are more likely to be violent. Fundamental basis baseline. The variable at the end is called daily urban habits. Now this is written by a black man, this scale. Sometimes, how many people have heard of a stress inventory? Basically they say if you move, you get some points. You get divorced, the dog dies. Anything, you get points. And we should have black on there, huh? Because being black creates a stressor, does it not? Now I want you to know, being black and living in this skin, we've normalized the stress. Haven't we? It happens so often and they wonder why you act up when you get to the office. Because by the time you get to the office, you will have been assaulted so many times before you got there. You know, the person that somehow you're standing in front of them but you're invisible to. By the time you get to work, the person that's sitting right next to you that doesn't say hello to you. You know, because that happens every time. You're invisible at work. We all black people are invisible at white environments for a number of reasons. I don't have time to talk about that. But one of them is, in African culture, this is what we always do. And you know what? If I see you this morning, I see you later on, I'm going to do that again. Mm-hmm. Because it's something we do. And you have people where greeting is perfunctory, so they'll look at you and keep going. Standing right next to you. Or they'll go, excuse me, can you get me those papers? What black people going to say? Hello? Good morning. Good afternoon. Right? Oh, well, hi. Could you get me those papers? Right? Because we have a very different experience living here in America. But one of the things that I understand is not respecting a person and the idea of the stressors associated with being black, put an electrodes on a black man when a police car drives up behind him. Let's measure that stress. I have to name these because I'm not going to have time to talk to talk about them. You must get, after you get mine. One is called Breaking Rank. Norm Stamper, 34-year police veteran, chief of police for Seattle, retired, chief of police for San Diego, retired, wrote a book called Breaking Rank, has a chapter entitled Why White Cops Kill Black Men. Whole chapter. He told on everybody. And when he broke rank, he took folks down. He took them down. I don't know what happened to this man, but he started telling the truth. There is a slide you have to show. And that is the one where it says, oh, you don't live there. Yeah, sorry. I'm sorry. I didn't see it. He said, I've heard some police officers refer to prostitute slayings or to the slayings of blacks as misdemeanor murders, employing an unofficial code for this, NHI, no human involved. San Diego cops confessed to a myriad other acts of discriminating, including additional dehumanizing references to blacks on a radio call just at 11:13 nigger, 11:13 being a code for an injured animal, followed by, a descriptor dog, cat, skunk. It was a pernicious form of discriminating injected with a large dose of misogyny that led to the labeling of the lone female officer in my academy class as a split tail, speculated as something to do with a woman's vagina. This man goes on to give statistics on how many police officers in every police department across the United States are predators, and saying that if you have a mother, a sister, a wife, a daughter, you should be afraid for them, because they become police officers to prey on women. He told. Now, I got to tell you, the man lives in a cabin on a mountain somewhere in the San Juan, so he knew it was going to happen. This is a situation where, again, I'm not going to have time to cover that, but let me move on and move back to the violent scale. Very good book, very important. I think black folks should keep it on the dash of the car. Because they may say we're paranoid, but folks are following us according to the data there. Another book you need to read, All God's Children. Fox Butterfield wrote the book. Fox Butterfield talked about violence And here you find out who pushed whom first. Perfect representation of post-traumatic slave syndrome if you want to see it in the life of a gentleman. That actually was the reason why we started trying youth as adults. His this particular situation here, let me read this one, because I think this is an amazing one. Last one I read. According to Butterfield, what emerged was not just a portrait of the Boskett, the gentleman Willie Boskett, the one who is now serving consecutive life terms. Youth tried as adult because of Willie Boskett, but a new account of the origin and growth of violence in the United States. Violence is not, as many people today presume, a recent problem or a peculiarly urban bane. Rather, it grew out of a proud culture that flourished in the antebellum rural South, a tradition shaped by whites long before it was adopted and recast by some blacks in reaction to their plight. The records also show that the vast majority of people put on trial for violent crimes in antebellum South Carolina were whites. The slaves were believed to be or thought to be a gentle people. Butterfield describes two forms of violence among the lower and upper classes, knockdown, drag out, where individuals often had their nose, eyes, or ears ripped from their bodies, and dueling, shooting and killing as a means for gentlemen to settle disputes. Now, I want to put this in perspective in terms of my research that looked at respect. Are you following me? What was modeled is honor and manhood. How does a 16-year-old black male in America get respect? Remember who modeled it. A duel is just a dressed-up drive-by. But what I understand about that how are you a man as a black man in America? If you don't have the material means to assert dominance or control over your resources, you have learned helplessness. Research tells us that too. Or you have hyper-masculinity, where I've got to assert my manhood somewhere and somehow. So I'll strike fear in you. Survival, adaptation. How do you learn to survive and adapt in a hostile environment? That's what black people have done all this time. And sometimes we heal crooked. Sometimes we did. But let me tell you this one thing. I don't know, where am I in time? Okay, I'm gonna let me just move, and I'll give you time to give me questions. But I want to give you put the slide up in terms of adaptation. What I did discover in my research, by the way, is that all my hypotheses are correct. The more urban hassles, more violence, more victimization, more violence, more witnessing, more violence. Racial socialization, middle variable, written by Stevenson, Howard Stevenson, out of Penn State, black man. He said, this is a resiliency factor, so pay attention to this. He suggested racial socialization as an important way of measuring how black people cope and adapt. Well, what is racial socialization? You help black children, black men, women know that you're walking out on a racially charged battlefield, but you give them armor. I'm going to tell you, you don't have to be worried. You don't have to trust what my high school counselor told me, which was that I wasn't college material. Don't trust that. But you know what? We got your back. You got a God. You got mama, daddy, big mama, big daddy. We here for you. And guess what? You're not a descendant of slaves after all. You're a descendant of captured free men and women. And you know what? It's going to be all right because joy comes in the morning. And we found out that the way you socialize a black child, you have less violence. I look right here at Portland. 200 African-American males, 100 incarcerated, 100 were not. Some of them were in the Rites of Passage program. People know Kevin Fuller. Yeah, I used that as a control group, and I used 100 of them that were incarcerated, and found out that those who were racially socialized were less likely to be violent. But more important was what I discovered about respect. And what I discovered about respect is that when you disrespect black males, and what do they do in prison? They try to break them. You're going to create a prisoner. Mm-hmm. Now, you're going to create a criminal. You're going to create a sociopath. Because if you disrespect him, you're going to have more violence. And guess what? I put all the variables, multiple regression, stepwise, regression analysis. So I wanted to look at all the variables and how they behaved and performed. Highest, greatest predictors of violence. What were the most significant predictors of violence among African-American male youth? All 200 of them? After victimization and witnessing fell out? Respect. Now, more importantly, what does respect mean? What does respect mean to a black male? I ask people, what does respect mean? I ask white men. White men told me it means earned regard. When I ask black men, they said it's a sense of worth and value. Much deeper, isn't it? Guess what respect means? Doesn't mean either of those, by the way. Comes from the Latin. Respect. Look again. That's what respect means. Look at me again. Don't look the first time. Look again. That's what it means to respect. And that's all these young men were saying, please look at me again. And I want you to put that in context. I see you. Look again. That's what my research taught me, that these young men wanted you to look at them again. But we can't look past our socialization in America. So we need to socialize them. These are the destructive behaviors. Let's look at the corrective behaviors. I'll just put it up there and we'll talk about them. Because we did have, not pathology, we have resiliency built up. These are the things we've used through the years, and I've broken them down from Ma'afa all the way to current status, the things. And I want to note for you that during Katrina, after we all know little was done, they employed the very same methods to wrap you in so that you would go to sleep, to subjugate and oppress. What do you have to do to subjugate or oppress any group of people? You must justify the behavior by what? Relabeling them, and after all, they're just looters and rapists.
Mm-hmm.
Then they wrap you in that and go black.
Mm-hmm.
More died after that. I've been in the Ninth Ward. My family's from Louisiana. But they don't even tell you the number that died after Katrina. They don't even tell you about it because they've already convinced you they're bad people, even here in Portland. In Dallas, everywhere. We've relabeled them so everybody can wrap themselves in that. So we do have positive behaviors. We do understand once we look at some of these behaviors around how we look at each other, how our attitudes, we can, in fact, turn them around, but you can't change what you don't know. The book is full of those. I certainly didn't have enough time in this day to share it. I don't do justice to what the book does because it does go in great depth. Chapter 6, which is a chapter on healing, the reason I wrote the book, note the title, Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, America's Legacy of Enduring Injury and Healing. We can heal. Imagine we've come this far with no help. Imagine how much more we can do if we understand it. And we can start changing it. Thank you very much.
Sure, the rest of the audience did also. I'm just kind of bowled over. That really, really impacted me. I don't really know where to start. So what I would like, we don't have any time. We were supposed to end at 1:30, but I just was not going to interrupt her. And, if people have any questions, this is the time, or you can wait till it's over. Thank you.
In comparison, when you talk about Katrina, first thing that I when I heard about Katrina, the first thing I thought about was Vanport.
Of course.
It's one of the same.
Of course.
So.
And Vanport played the displacement. All the things were the same, and also the disparity with what black people who experienced, not just black people, but poor whites as well. Matter of fact, they used to do I don't know if they do it now for incoming professors here at Portland State. They used to show a video of the making, because this was called Vanport College. And the first time I saw it, not only was there not a black person in it, there were no women in the whole video, and they thought that was okay. So I complained a lot and brought pictures and gave it to them. So anyone that's seen it, I don't know if they've added black folks in there, but when I first came into the program, there were no black people apparently. But there were poor blacks and whites in Vanport, that place called Vanport, and the flood killed far more than what the newspaper account said, based on the accounts of the people themselves, right? So you still had that, and then you had, again, further displacement, and again, displaced again. So these are things that are, again, right up in front of us. It happens, and we are silent, which is the reason why it continues that.
Can I just make an announcement?
Sure.
On November 21st, Joanne Bowman from Oregon Action is going to be here to be our next speaker for the Black Bag. And Avel Gordley I think she left. Hi, Avelle. Avelle is going to host that event. I won't be here, and so I hope all of you can be in attendance for that event also. Thank you.
Yeah, I know. You Grandly, I got a book for you. I told you I'd give you a book. I'm giving you a book, too.
Do you have any here?
I brought one little box of books. So if anybody wants a book, I have...
I want one with your signature.
Okay, well, why don't I do that right now? Okay, I'm going to do that because I know they're going to close us down. You can always come up and ask. You want to have a question or something?
No, for a book.
And you can't leave, but you know where my car is. But I saw the sister...
Yeah, I've been away from Portland for a long time. And when I come back, there's two things that strike me as a black woman.